I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Golden State Warriors basketball player, tech investor, and philanthropist Andre Iguodala, whose new memoir is The Sixth Man. He's joined in conversation by writer and podcaster Carvell Wallace.
Hello, everyone, and Shabbat Shalom. I'm Craig Salgado, Chief Operating Officer here at the JCC, and on behalf of the entire JCC community, it's my pleasure to welcome you to this evening's program with Andre Iguodala and Carvell Wallace. For nearly 15 years, he's been an indomitable force in the NBA, and most recent years as the sixth man for the Golden State Warriors. Go Dubs. He is also one of the most admired players in the NBA, both on the court and off the court, for his successful tech investments, his philanthropy, and increasingly for his contributions to the national discussion about race in America. He's here this evening to talk about his powerful new memoir of life in basketball, The Sixth Man, which offers insights into how he became the man, the superstar athlete, and a true mensch he is today. Appearing tonight in conversation with Andre is writer and podcast host Carvell Wallace, co-author of The Sixth Man, who has covered sports, culture, music, race, and the arts for ESPN, MTV, The New Yorker, and The New York Times. Let's give a very warm JCCSF welcome to Andre Iguodala and Carvell Wallace.
That was impressive.
Thank you. Good night, everyone. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Do you get that a lot when you...
That was some great enthusiasm,
yeah.
Actually. I think that's the first time my son saw it in this setting, so...
And your son is here tonight.
He doesn't think Dad is that cool. I'm just regular to him. So hopefully that has its effects in a good way.
Well, obviously, there's a lot of people here who do think you're that cool. And I want to start with the most recent stuff, which is, this last year, this championship.
Yes.
Run. And first of all, how are you feeling now a few weeks out from the way everything went there?
Oh.
What does it feel like at this point?
I mean, to be honest, it was a little bit of a relief with so much that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of just guys just falling apart, it wasn't aligned with what was supposed to happen. You know,
right.
Everything happens for a reason. I feel like everything happens the way it's supposed to, and it just wasn't for us. And I'm just hoping. I think everyone is
right.
At peace because we gave it our all. We gave our maximum effort, and sometimes that's what it's about. You know, the effort and energy you put forth. Sometimes that's what it's all about. You have to reflect and say, hey, this is the best we could do. Didn't work out for us. And you have to congratulate the other team and say, job well done and congratulations. And you look forward to rest because we've been doing this for like a long time. I don't think, I mean, there hasn't been a team since the Celtics in like the 60s or 50s to make this many runs at it consecutively. So I think I heard... Aisha saying there's a lot of nine irons and drivers, and it's good to take a step away and, you know, come back ready with that competitive edge when it's time to get back on the court.
You know, this is an interesting thing. You bring up this idea of to be at peace after a loss.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of what we're told about what it takes to be a great athlete has to do with this hyper-competitivism, right?
Yes.
Refusal to lose. It's never good enough. You're always there. It's all you ever care about is. And I wonder how you as an athlete balance that competitiveness, which I assume you have, which is why you're here.
Right.
How do you find that drive and also be at peace? How do those things work together for you?
Well, I think we're just competitors in nature. And I think when you look at the top of the food chain in terms of professional sports, and the one in, I don't know what that number is, one in 10 million, 20 million, or whatever it is, of professional athletes, I think we try to set ourselves apart in terms of our competitive drive. And whatever we do, we're really competitive. I always joke with my son. I say, he didn't have to grow up in the environment that I grew up in terms of you were forced to have that hunger, you were forced to have that grit. But he has a competitive edge, and he hates to lose. He gets so frustrated. I mean, he's hitting the ball well in the range today. He had one bad shot, and he just falls apart. But at the same time, like, that's it.
Yeah.
Like, you get it. Like, when I was younger, I was a sore loser. Like, it was so bad. Like, I cried and, like, losing anything. Like, I cried when I lost, like, a math challenge. Like, it was just math challenge. But looking back, I'm like, that's it. Yeah. Like, when you can't accept losing, you know, and that drives you to extend yourself when you're tired, or when you've gone 4 or 5 days in a row and 2-a-days, like, then that's when you're able to get that discipline to drive yourself and have that hunger to get better and better.
Was there a point at which you felt like you learned how to lose, or a series of points at which you look back and go, okay, that's when I learned how to do this gracefully?
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't think I ever learned. Just recently, probably. But I think it's when, you know, when I really learned it? When I was in Philadelphia, and there was a lot of expectations, and we had to, you know, they don't accept anything except winning. But when it was all said and done, I had to reflect a few times. I didn't reflect on it until after I was gone already. So, I mean, when we were talking about the book, yeah. I always say it was kind of therapeutic for me, because I said, you know, I felt like I was failing in Philadelphia when we didn't win as much as, you know, everyone would like for us to. But when I was reflecting on it, I said, hey, you look at our roster, and you look at the talent that we had, the youth we had a lot of young guys. That was the best. We exceeded expectations.
Yeah.
And sometimes in sports, as you just touched upon it, you know, you're taught if you don't win, you fail. But in actuality, is if you've maximized yourself, you put forth your best effort, only you know that. But I was been into basketball for so long, I can sense it now. I'm like, okay, this is the ceiling for that team. This is the ceiling for that team. Some are higher than others. And we exceeded expectations many years in Philadelphia. So now I appreciate it. And even the guys on that team, we have these special bonds, and we all know it, but it's tough in sports to know that while you're in it in that present moment. It's always like you have to reflect and really understand it.
Yeah, I also want to talk a little bit about that sense of reflection. I mean, the Warriors run, which you've been a part of, I mean, it kind of coincides with your arrival here.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of us who are long-suffering Warriors fans, there's a reason they call us long-suffering. And what was so just tremendous to me to watch, I tweeted this the other day, like, people always talk about bandwagon fans, but it seemed to me the Warriors had a lot of bandwagon haters. People that just out of in 2012 had no opinion about the Warriors. Now, 2016, all of a sudden, the Warriors, like, they hate them and they want them to lose all the time. And I wondered, like, just what was your experience for sort of going through that whole run?
Well, it's always, you talk about the roller coaster ride, and the NBA season or the NBA, your lifespan is a roller coaster ride from the ups and downs, because there's so many games. So you can be playing a peak one night and then you just bottom out the next. So it's all about the ebbs and flows and how you can balance it all out. And that was interesting in terms of our fanfare. The Bay Area has always had a strong fan base. Even when the team wasn't doing so well, like Oracle was always a great environment, and a lot of people don't realize that. So when we're doing well, and we win our first one, and Steph's the darling, and you know, in their eyes, he can do no wrong, and they can't wait to see him come on the road, and we're selling out every road game. To where the villains, that was like a 2-month thing. Like you went from one extreme to the other in like 60 days, and nothing occurred with any of the players. You know, we were still the same. So that was interesting to go through. Although,
what do you think that is? I mean, having been around and watched a lot of, and just watched fans' reactions, what do you think? I don't want you to speculate too much in fan psychology, right, but what do you think makes that happen for people where they suddenly start hating a team?
I think that's the newness of sports, especially with the 24-hour news cycle. And it's like a reality show kind of vibe to it. Like, it sits on the side, and then that's the NBA's marketing machine.
Right.
So the NBA does, you know, we're at the forefront of so many different things, whether it be forefront of race relations or how we handle our political issues or in the tech space or the relationship between the commissioner and our union head or the relationship between our owners and the players. They just recently changed the name of the majority stakeholders from owner to governor. Mm. So we're always at the forefront of things. But the NBA has this thing where it's this continuous news cycle, like it's yearly. Right. So it starts with the season and training camp, and everyone's excited, and who's going to the championship, and then they can kind of run it into right around the season starting off, tip off, and you got a couple of marquee games, and that goes into Christmas. Mm-hmm. Christmas Day is this big celebration, and then you got a few marquee matchups in there, and then who's doing really well, and you're watching them, and who's doing really bad, and who's underachieving, right, and then that ride that wave into All-Star break, and All-Star break's a huge event, yeah, and then you come on an All-Star break, and there's a little halt, but then you talk about the playoff push, yeah, and then that playoff push is really, and then you go into the trade deadline before, yeah, the playoff push, so the trade deadline's this, mm-hmm, huge thing now.
Yeah.
Then you go into the playoff push, then you go into the finals.
Yeah.
The day after the finals is who's going to be number one pick.
Yeah.
And then you run into the draft.
And then free agency.
Now the draft's over if you got free agency. And then free agency is as crazy as the life of itself now, and then that runs into summer league.
Right.
Then the summer league gets over, and it's a cycle all over again. So they do a really good job of marketing the game, but that keeps everyone engaged. But I'll try to talk about it in a market sense where you can be overexposed at times, and I hope the game never gets in that place where it's overexposed.
Yeah.
And people can get too tired of it. Could talk about it. Somebody mentioned it about football. You don't want a Friday or Saturday game. I think Mark Cuban said it. It was like football was like, it was Sunday was that day.
Yeah.
And now they have Monday, and then,
yeah,
they have Thursday,
yeah,
and then they have Saturdays in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it can be too much. So,
yeah,
hopefully we can find that sweet spot where there isn't too much talk. Because when you got too much talk,
right,
you got to find people to talk to or people that have something to say. And then you have voices,
yeah,
that shouldn't be in the game that are in the game. And I think some voices that are in the game, they're bringing some stuff that doesn't reflect how we want the game to be seen. And I think that's where a lot of the noise comes from.
Yeah, and I also wonder, too, and like, and right now you're like in the middle of this. I mean, I sit at home and marvel over the way that the press cycle works whenever anyone is selling anything, if they're selling a book,
right,
or whatever. They go out, they do the appearances, they say the things, 40-minute interview, they say half of a sentence. Everyone's like, what? They said that?
Right.
And then all of it, social media thinks that they just went up, like got on a platform and just like yelled that through a megaphone.
Right.
And then the whole story becomes about everyone's reaction to that and people writing think pieces about that. And I wonder if you feel like the league is doing a good enough job or whoever is doing a good enough job in preparing young players to understand how that works.
Well, I think the best lessons are through experience. Mm-hmm. So luckily, we didn't have social media. We didn't have Twitter. Thank God we didn't. We just couldn't do, like, crazy. Because they're going back and finding guys' Twitters from when they were 8 years old and, right, some of the things they were saying. And it's like, And then a lot of guys were saying some things about LeBron. Now they're his teammates. You know, it was like, it's crazy. It's crazy how that's working. So I was just fortunate enough to be in that sweet spot where I was around before. And then I was in right around the middle when everything started to come out. So I can kind of tailor things a little bit better and not expose myself too much. But that's just become the nature of it and what clickbait means. Mm. And everyone's trying to leverage themselves to get to be the next Stephen A. Smith or Max Kellerman or Shannon Sharp or anyone else who's got a platform to talk about sports. And the new platform is to be loud. And Jermaine O'Neal had one of the best arguing points I've ever heard. He said, just because you're loud doesn't mean you're right. He was talking to a teammate. So that was always funny to me. But our... You know, that's why a lot of the valuations of our teams of the league is going up and up, because there's so many eyeballs, and the more eyeballs and the more with social media, everyone wants to feel a part of it. And I'll talk about that balance. When you first get in the league, you know, you want to represent the NBA. You know, we want you to show the fans, get the fans, get a close up close and personal with you. You know, tweet and you know, show your stories on Instagram. But at the same time, you forget we're in a very blessed situation, and you got a lot that are, there's jealousy and envy that comes in there, and there's a lot of pressure and a lot of negative feedback that we see because we have been told to get close to our fans. So, like I said, you got to have that balance to where you're not overdoing it and you're not overexposing yourself to a lot of things that come with that. The negativity from the social media side.
That seems such a tricky balance. And I remember, you know, when we were talking about your years in Philadelphia, you told me that Allen Iverson told you not to read the newspaper, which was a new thing for you because you had grown up reading the newspaper. That was like kind of one of your main things. But this idea that, like, if a player read the paper and the paper was like, well, this guy can't shoot, this guy can't ball handle, this guy keeps turning it over, then they would start to play in reaction to that rap that they would get, the knock on them, and it would mess up a guy's game. And it seems to me that not only was that true then, but that's got to be a million times more true now.
Right.
Are guys checking, and you don't have to name any names, but are guys checking Twitter halftime? Are people looking at Instagram? Or like, what's
There was an article about it, and this was a couple years ago. A player was like, it's normal for guys to check their phones at halftime now. And that was just league-wide.
Right.
And when I first came in the league, it was like, what are you doing? Right. And then I started seeing, I'm like, what are y'all doing? Put your phone down. But now I even catch myself doing it, just grab my phone.
Right.
And then for me, if I'm too excited or if I don't have the energy, I'll know to grab like a quick... a little quick brain game to kind of lock myself in, like, all right, let's get locked and loaded. Or I'll read something from Headspace app. You know, they usually have different quotes on how you can be at calm or and be in the present. So some guys it helps, some guys it doesn't help. But that was a big thing a couple years ago. It was a big article about that. Was like that, you know, you just naturally go, as soon as you sit down, you grab your phone.
Right.
Because you're waiting on coaches to come back. But there are negative effects, I feel like, when you're trying, because now we're not playing basketball because we love it. We're playing basketball to prove someone wrong. And we're just checking to see, like, okay, like you said, someone says, well, he's shooting bad. So now you're thinking about that, and you're not just going out there shooting. You're shooting to prove someone else wrong instead of shooting to help your team win.
Yeah, well, that brings me to another question I want to talk a little bit about, because I know we have some young athletes here. Mm-hmm. I want to go back to this thing about the feeling of winning and losing and how you find balance in that. And you know, you said you felt at peace about this loss because you know that you put everything out, the one that happened. Did you feel the same way 3 years ago when you guys lost in Game 7?
Oh.
Did that feel different? Like, how was that? Like,
that one was different. I was a different upset with that one. Right. Just the way I was upset about how it happened, you know, how everything flowed throughout the series from game to game and the different dynamics that happened throughout that series. That bothered me on a different level. So I've learned this week to keep some things to myself. I was just upset. I wasn't like, I don't look back and say, you know, we should have won or this happened to me, that's not right. I just look at it as a learning experience going forward. What I do get frustrated in is, you know, they don't want us to express our admiration for our peers and guys we go up against. Like, every time I play against anybody, like, I want to win, and I want to I want to destroy them. But at the same time, you know, I respect these guys in their game. Like, yo, these are some amazing players, and a lot of guys that have gone through some stuff that none of us can imagine. And for them to be here is a blessing. And, you know, you're just happy for people that, you know, look like you to have success as well.
You're listening to Golden State Warriors basketball player, tech investor, and philanthropist Andre Iguodala, whose new memoir is The Sixth Man. He's joined in conversation by Carvell Wallace on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
When you take home that feeling of being upset about the way things go and it's over and you can't turn back the clock and you can't fix it, how do you recover from that? Like, what is your method for recovering from that?
Well, I mean, whether things are going good or bad, I have one thing I do. I just golf. So if things are going really good, I'm like, cool, I'm about to go shoot par. And then if things are going really bad, Sam's going to work on my game. And then, because when you're playing golf, it's so hard. Imagine doing something so hard, you can't think about anything else. Because if you do, you're going to be really bad. So I just found that place of peace for me. And it's really changed, you know, how I move on a daily basis or how I think about things. Because that game is so hard that you can apply it to anything that you do. You know, I told Bob Myers today, and if you want some clickbait, here you go. I told Bob Myers today, I said, I just need to play golf with you two times. It doesn't matter who you are. If I play golf with you two rounds, I figure you out. Yeah. If you're a good person, if you're a bad person, if you're a cheater, if you're a sore loser, it's really hard to find good company in golf. Yeah. It's really hard. And when you find, if you find yourself like, yo, I really enjoy playing with you, like, that's a good person. Yeah. Like, that's how I found out how I find my friends.
Yeah. Love that. You know, it seems that I was looking, in prepping for this, I was looking over some old footage of the team from 2015, 2016. It seems to me that there was something special about the way that you guys regarded each other, the respect you had for each other. That's what it felt like from the outside. Did it feel that way for you? What did you think made those teams so much better than the rest of the league, at least at that time?
Yeah, well, I think the stars were really aligned. I keep saying it's like the stars were aligned. And when you look at how our team was built, from two kids who had parents that played in the NBA, with Steph and Clay, and they're not fazed by the fame, and it's like just normal to them, you know, so that they don't overreact to any situation that comes from around the game. And you look at an underdog like Draymond, who second-round pick, was overlooked because of his size, and how he was a great balance with his demeanor and his personality from someone like Steph. And then perfect timing with me being able to come in with Steph having an ankle issue early on. And then, you know, with the way Mark Jackson did things with coaching them from a coaching philosophy, and then from Steve Kerr. Steve Kerr coming in at a perfect time because he and I went to the same college. We had the same basketball philosophy, so I was able to adjust to a new roles very easily, very smoothly, because I could understand what he was trying to do. And that building that environment in that short period of time, and when you build that environment, I talk about Steph all the time because he's at the forefront of it. When you have a superstar who's so humble and so normal, it's easy to come in and enjoy work. You know, you don't have most superstars, they complain or moan about, you know, practice is too long, or I scored 35 last night, I don't have to practice today. Right. You know, he's the total opposite. You know, let's just go to work, let's maximize our talents. And he set that tone early on. And then other guys start seeing it when we're going up against them. You know, that's what I saw going up against Steph and going up against Clay, is these guys are just enjoying playing basketball. Like, they aren't thinking about anything else. They're not thinking about themselves. They're not thinking about endorsement deals. All they're thinking about is, I'm going to go out and just shoot the ball tonight and watch it go through the hoop.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful feeling. So other guys see it as well. And we're able to add the most talented player of our generation in Kevin Durant. And beautiful things just continue to happen on a higher level. And it's just been a great run so far. And we look forward to continuing the run.
Yeah. I was watching also the final series recently, and I was thinking about great shooters and what happens when they go through slumps.
Mm-hmm.
And shooting is so mysterious to me, because how do people do that is basically my question, right? And when someone is amazing at it and you watch them when they're hot, it seems like they can't ever miss.
Right.
And they're making these insane shots. And then there are times when you watch people go through these slumps. And I wonder, just from your own experience shooting and playing the game and being around a lot of players, and also specifically seeing Steph and Clay, what do they go through in those times when they go 2-for-14? Does it get in their head? And also on the flip side, what is it like for someone like Clay when he's 37 and a quarter? Like,
right.
What do you see?
Well, seeing them miss, it doesn't affect us the way it affects other people.
Mm.
Because, well, those two have, like, more so Clay, he has this awesome mentality where he forgets what happened like 2 seconds ago. Right? So, that is an amazing skill. I wish I had. So I talk to Steve Kerr about it all the time, and I have the opposite problem.
Yeah.
I remember something that happened 2 years ago.
Right.
So it's something stuck in my head, and it's like playing golf. I always tell, whether it's my son or anybody I'm playing with, like, just focus on the ball. And then today my son looked up at me and started laughing, and he tried to swing. He missed the ball. Because he's thinking about something else, where all Clay is thinking about is the next time I touch the ball, it's going in the hole.
Yeah.
So he doesn't know he's 2-for-14. So I think that's the first step in. If you're 2-for-14, how do you get out of the slump? You don't know you're in a slump. So but seriously, that is an amazing trait to have. But I will add to that. If Clay is in a slump, I know he's in a slump. Like, Draymond and I, we're aware of, we're hyper aware of certain things. We're still looking for him.
Right.
We're here looking for him and Steph more than anybody else. Like,
right.
I get the ball. Where's Steph? Where's Clay? Like,
right.
I don't care what you are. It's coming right back.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like the stock market. It always corrects itself.
Right.
And
right.
They shoot a high clip, and that's, normal. So it's going to correct to come back to a high clip.
Yeah. Well, that thing that you said about, remembering stuff that from 2 years ago, that kind of reminds me of what people like so much about your game.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about this a little bit in the book, especially when you moved to the six-man role, that part of what you learned in that role was that you were to come off the bench and understand the flow of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked a lot about how each game is different. There's a different flow to it. What's happening? How are people moving? Not just X's and O's, how are people being defended, but what is the vibe and flow of it? And I guess I want to hear you talk a little bit about what that experience is like for you to come into a game and get a read on what happened, what's happening.
Right. So most six men come in, like Lou Williams, where he comes in and just go to work. In terms of, the ball's in your hands, and we're looking for you to score 20-some points off the bench, which is a tough thing to do. You got some of the best six-man NBA history. I think Dedler Shrimp might have been in that role for a hot second. Tony Kukoc, Jamal Crawford, Lou Williams, Eric Gordon did it for a hot second. Forgetting a few other guys, but your role is to come in and shoot, right? So my role was a little different, and I had to, adjust on the fly and figure out what that meant. And that meant just paying attention to, the subtleties of the game, whether it be, okay, Clay's got a certain bounce in his step. Like, I know Clay's bounce.
Mm.
He's got this bounce, right? And I'm like, oh, okay, he's got it.
Mm-hmm.
And always in L.A., too. He's got that bounce in L.A. all the time. Or against certain players.
Yeah.
He plays against certain guys. I know, Clay's got that bounce.
Right.
And then with Steph, I'm watching him, too, to see. Because sometimes Steph comes out and he's firing right away. or he's going to let the game come to him and figuring that thing out too. Draymond, he makes his first shot. I'm like, okay, cool. I know where he's thinking right now. So you're just watching your teammates, seeing where they're at, and that allows me to figure out what my role is on the fly. So it took me a while to figure it out, but once I figured it out, I've learned to embrace it, and I've maximized it. So I know when to come out and attack, or versus knowing when to just let them do their things and stay out their way. I spoke about it earlier today. Sometimes getting out the way is the right and the most effective play. Right. And when you're in professional sports and there's that ego and that pride and there's me, and I want to show that I'm helping out, you tend to get in the way, and then, you know, it's in the clash with everyone else, and it doesn't flow as well as it should, and nobody can figure it out. And I think the question I was asking in the interview earlier was parts of the game that analytics can't read, or it doesn't show up when you're in advanced analytics, and that's part of the game that will never show up on a stat sheet, it will never show up in advanced analytics, but just knowing how, sometimes getting out the way is the perfect play.
You know, it seems to me from knowing about your childhood, your background, that a lot of that lack of ego in the sports area comes from the way you were raised and where you fit into your family and just the experience you had. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like for you growing up?
Well, we had a big family in terms of from my grandmother. She had a foster and she had a foster home, and she adopted a few kids as well. And then she had like 8 kids. You know, half were in Kansas City, Missouri, and the other half was in Springfield, Illinois. So we had a lot of family gatherings at my grandmother's house, and at one point I was staying in the apartment upstairs. So it was always 10 to 15 people around, like just constantly. So you learn to be able to get along with others. You learn to fend for yourself at times. You learn to... we talked about this a little bit. We had a huge edit in the book, but we had a cracking jokes are really good for you as a kid. Like for some, I always tell my son, like, you gotta learn how to crack jokes on people, and then you gotta learn how to be able to receive jokes. Yeah. Those are humbling experiences, but it keeps you on, like, it keeps you on par. You know, it keeps you aware.
Yeah.
And like, I have a certain awareness on the court. I can notice something about a guy, because younger, it was like I couldn't figure out how to crack jokes on people. And they go crack jokes in my ear. They say I had big ears, call me Dumbo all the time. I didn't have any jokes come back, but my stepbrother, when we became roommates, he was like, man, you got to pay attention. Like, look at his shoes. Look at his shirt. Look, man, his hat too big. Like, so I was like, oh, I get it now. So it's funny because I've been able to take that. Like, I just explained about, I can see, I know Clay's bounce in his step. Yeah. Yeah. I know Steph, when he has a certain look. I got that from cracking jokes on people.
Right. Yeah, also, growing up, you know, a lot of players were always the best wherever they went, and that was their experience. And, you know, it's a little bit of a wake-up call when they get to a certain level and they're no longer the best. They're, you know, they're one of the best from everywhere else. But that wasn't your experience growing up. You weren't the star of every team that you played on growing up. Is that...
Yeah, so I was a star up until a certain point, which was around when you hit around high school. You know, it's the big boys, so I kind of had to work my way up, and I had this really big growth spurt from my freshman to sophomore year of high school, and even then, no one really knew the talent I quite had. And we had a phenom a year younger than me who was nationally ranked. Started on a varsity team as a freshman. I mean, he was getting recruited by D1 schools in the eighth grade. You know, he was getting letters. So I wasn't quite at that level yet. Actually, I was better at track and field, which I thought I was going to go to college for that. But that was it was best for me. Like, that was a really good pocket for me to be in, because I was able to watch him from afar, start working out with him. I fully fell in love with the game around that time. We were just playing basketball every day. It was pure. And that was it was a humbling experience as well, because it's like, all right, now I see where I can go, how much better I can get. Like, what is he doing that I can do? And we built a very strong relationship, very strong bond. We still have to this day. And that was a good time for me to go through, you know, to kind of figure out where I fit in. I always talk about how important confidence is in the NBA, and your confidence can waver on a daily basis. And it's a fine line. You know, there's guys who you've never heard of who could be superstars in the league, but if you get in the wrong system, a coach might not have as much confidence in you, so you don't have the confidence in yourself, you'll never reach your maximum potential. Around that time, I was figuring out my confidence because I didn't quite know how good I was, so in turn, the coach didn't know how good I was. And it took me to follow the footsteps of a guy who was younger than me, and I didn't have an issue with that. He was on the national traveling team, and then I get a minute here, 2 minutes there. Slowly but surely, I'm figuring out. I'm like, oh, you start figuring out, like, okay, I'm just as good as him in this area. I'm just as good in this area. Oh, I'm okay, I'm pretty good. And then you go back home, you work on it, you gain some confidence, and you're practicing on the people back home because you're better than them. And then that was that whole summer before my senior year where I just kept rising the rankings because I was doing things that I had this whole time. I didn't realize that I didn't realize I had them, and then they just start slowly but surely coming out.
How do you balance the need to have confidence? You talk a lot about this in the book. In some ways, this is probably the biggest thing I learned from you working on the book with you, was the way in which we have to develop confidence and the way in which the specific ways in which we use confidence to navigate through difficult situations. How do you balance that with the need for humility? Because they seem like they're opposites. How do you navigate your way through that?
So I can go back to one point in chapel. We have chapel before every game in every arena, and we were in chapel and we were talking about being humble, being selfless, and what that means. And he was like, "What are you guys struggling with?" And I said, "I'm struggling with, you know, being humble and the humility side of things. But at the same time, and when I play my best, I feel like I'm better than everybody." And that's that confidence. Like, I felt it in game six in the finals, like, I'm better than everybody out here.
Right.
And you go out there and you feel like you can do anything. But more so than anything, more so than that, you have to know the work you put in. Like I said before, only you know if you worked hard. Only you know if you've been in the gym countless hours working on your jump shot. Only you know you actually work on, you're one of the few that work on defensive drills. Only you know your intentions and everything you do within your profession, you try to do it to perfection. And you try to do it with good intentions, not only for yourself, but only for your teammates. So I always try to take that approach. So I know that I'm working really hard. But at the same time, you're trying to be humble about it. And I asked the chaplain, like, sometimes I go back and watch my old film. Like, when I'm in a rut, I just go to YouTube, type in my name, look up. No, I really need this sometimes. Like, it's like, I need it. So I'm like, oh, you can go find YouTube clips. I think it's like a Phoenix Suns game and a Lakers game. It's a couple of games where I didn't miss. And I'll just watch those games, and I'm like, okay. And then I go to the gym the next day. I find that rhythm again. And I'm like, Jay-Z said it in one of his songs. It's like, sometimes you need your ego. You got to remind people, like, who you are, because sometimes they take you too lightly. You got to remind them, like, you know, don't take it too lightly. Like, I'm really good at this. So, but it's that balance. And I was like, how do I find that balance? Like, sometimes I feel bad. Like, is there something wrong with watching myself? And he was like, it's the balance of your profession and your sport. And I'm doing it with good intentions. I'm doing it to help the team win, so on, so forth. So, like you said, it's all about having a good balance.
Yeah. I mean, I relate to that. I sometimes have to go back and read things I wrote.
Yes.
To remind myself that I actually know how to write.
Yes.
Because I'll be looking at a blank page and I'll be like,
yes.
I forgot. How do you write again?
Yes.
Like Googling, how do you write an article?
That's a great point.
And I have to go back and read stuff and be like, okay, I'm good at this. I can do this. But I wonder about, I think there's not only in the game, not only in life, I mean, not only in the game, but also in life, there's a certain, you run up against challenges, people that don't want you to succeed, people that doubt you. And I wonder how being an athlete has helped you in other areas of your life.
So this is something like I preach in the home to like all my children. It's three kids, and I'm more so on a boy because he's a boy, and then the others are girls, so they'll be spoiled for the rest of their lives, so they don't have to do anything. But I always try to say, like, if you work really hard, you learn how to work hard, life is easy in terms of getting something done. So as a professional athlete, you have to beat out so many people. And I've gone through times where I've shot myself into like a dizziness, where I shoot and the body kind of got a little, things got a little fuzzy. I had to sit down and to do this. I remember doing this many a times, like, ah, just hold on, drink some water. It's like, all right, you can't stop. You got to keep going. You got to keep going. And then once you start seeing the benefits of it, once you start having, you know, individual or team success, you're like, man, that's just what it took. And then you're watching other guys you look up to, admire, doing the same thing. And then you're mentioning the same breath as them. You're like, oh, you're doing, this is what you're supposed to do. This is just work. And now it's not working hard anymore. It's just your daily routine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just the discipline of it. But once you figure that out, you can put that same energy into anything else. You apply that same energy to anything else, and you can have success. You know, it's almost like the Matrix. You know, you just plug it in and it just goes in your brain. I apply that to anything else. If I really want to be good at it, I'll just take myself into that mode of being on the basketball court and making 500 makes twice a day. And then I just apply it to that. And, you know, you got the, you know what your capacities are. You just go out and get it.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is Golden State Warriors basketball player, tech investor, and philanthropist Andre Iguodala, whose new memoir is The Sixth Man. He's joined in conversation by Carvel Wallace. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at KALW.org.
So that's such an interesting thing. Why do you think more people don't do that? If really all it takes is just to apply, you know, like just work really hard, why do you think most people don't do that?
It's hard. I mean, because I tell my son all the time, it's like if everybody could do it, they would do it. But hard work is something that very few people want to do. Now, I wouldn't say people work hard, and I think a lot of people work hard, especially those that are just trying to find the next meal. Like, that's a different type of work hard.
Right.
But I always say, once you learn how to sacrifice time, I should say that, you learn how to prioritize. So instead of being on your phone, or it's like I used to do homework. Fear is the beginning of wisdom, right? I've been saying that all week, right?
So it's fear is the beginning of wisdom.
Fear is the beginning of wisdom.
What do you mean by that?
Close friend of mine from back home. It's actually funny. Street guy turned into, like, he's an ordained minister now. Like, incredible human being. Like, it's my good friend, close friend. We came from, like, the projects, from, like, nothing. Like, from nothing. And he knows the Bible inside out. He said, fear is the beginning of wisdom. And you need fear sometimes. So I was so afraid of my mom that I had no choice but to sit there and get the homework done. Right? But once you learn, like, once I learned how to, like, read so many pages in a certain amount of time or get some homework done before the deadline, that stuff just got ingrained in me in an early age to where, like, that stuff I didn't want to do that I actually excelled at. So like I said, like, I know how to focus. Focusing is really hard. Like, focus is it's not easy to focus. And there's a lot of kids. I know how you are. Like, that is a task in itself to just sit down. Don't move for 2 minutes. But there's a discipline in that, you know, and then I do yoga now, I meditate, and I find myself, when I get in those rhythms where I'm just at present and I can focus and be intent with everything that I'm doing, that's when I'm most productive.
You mentioned,
but that's really hard.
Right.
Like, that's hard.
Right. You mentioned that you were motivated by fear of your mother when you were younger. What are you afraid of now?
My business partner Rudy, he's afraid that I'm not afraid of
anything.
He's afraid that I'm not afraid of anything now. So he's like, you'll say anything. You'll say what you think. You just express yourself. You're not afraid of anything, because it's like once you start getting a grand understanding of just life in itself or the way the world works, then, you know, I'm at peace because I've been able to go work hard. I've had an intent with what I'm doing. I know my intentions are pure. Like, I don't want to see anybody fail. I don't want to do any harm to anyone. The people that look like me, I want them to come up in a better situation that I'm in and leave the world in a better place. So I'm just good with, like, man, like, my son is like, he acts just like me, and it's like, he's smart. like he, school comes easy to him, and you know he can crack a joke on me now. So like I'm doing something right. Like, you know, I just try to go about life, and it's like, you know, if I see something, I'll address it. And I've really got into my spirituality or my faith. So I'm just really at peace. Like, as long as I take each day trying to become better and better every day, then I mean, what else is there to do but to do that? You know, whether it's reading or giving back information or taking care of my young teammates and making sure they're on the right track. That's, I get the most joy out of that. Like, when I look back in 5 years and the guy's still in the league who's not supposed to be in the league, I'm like, okay, you did it right. You know, you're really not supposed to be here. You know, you weren't. And that's not a bad thing. It's like, it's a guy that's on the cusp. He's on that edge. And it's like, if you're on that edge, you got to do the little things right. You know, you got to be early. You got to be late. You got to be respectful to everybody. You know, there's no ego there. You got to work really hard. And then, you know, there's really no vacations. So when you see those guys, it's like, he listened. He's still here. Like, that's when I get joy out of seeing.
We've had some of the most interesting conversations we had, I thought, when we were working on the book, are about success. And you said something, and I wonder if you still feel this way. This was maybe like a year or so ago. I asked you if you felt successful, and you really had to stop and think about it. And it didn't seem to me that you were sure that the answer was yes. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, do you feel successful in this moment, and if, what does that mean for you?
Yeah, success is is one of those things that I'm still trying to figure out. I guess maximizing yourself, I guess you can say that, because we define success in the wrong ways. You know, we define success in vanity and money and material things and our desires. But that's, once you get those things, you realize, like, no, this isn't success at all. Like, I try to explain to people, like, money isn't really all it's cracked up to be. You know, it puts you in a more comfortable situation where you don't have certain worries, but it's a whole nother bucket of problems that most people can't deal with or don't want to. Like, it's kind of crazy. So success is one of those things, especially being in America, being in the capitalist system where success is supposed to be found in, you know, in a currency. That's not it. So I guess I'll have to define it in a certain way where hopefully I am. But I still got a long way to go in life. And people have different paths. So one person's success may not be another person's success. So I still have goals and still have a ways to go before I feel like, oh, it was a successful life. But I still got work to do.
I guess I'm curious about what motivates you to keep trying new things. Like, a lot of people would be like, this is great. I've had a successful career. I've made good money. People are taken care of. Why write a book? Why do tech stuff? Why do all this other stuff?
So I think it started at, that's a really good question. That started at like a young age of wanting to separate myself, right? Especially looking the way I look. So I've had many situations where teachers would be like, I had a teacher tell me, you're never going to make it. You're going to be a loser. Or I had another teacher I talk about in the book who was like, you're in the wrong class. Like, this isn't the class you're supposed to be in, because I was the only black kid. It was one other black kid, but I looked like a black kid.
Just because you were in the advanced class.
It was the advanced English class. Yeah. She was like, wait, where are you going? I'm like, I'm going to class. And so imagine being 12 years old and the teacher's like, you're in the wrong room. I'm like, I know where I'm going. I can read. The 206 is the room I'm in. She's like, nah, you're not in. I'm like, what am I supposed to do? I'm just standing there like, my mother taught me respect. I can't disrespect her. I'm like, What are we going to do now? Am I going to stand here? We're just going to wait it out? Like, and she's like, let me see your schedule. Here's my schedule. Oh, you are in here. But then this is when I'm learning my environment and how people see me. And I'm like, she's giving me the side eye all the time. And I'm not her favorite. And the first essay, I write the essay. I found the best essay out of the class. It's written by Andre. I'm her favorite student the rest of the year. Right? But it's just that perception thing, and I lost track of where I was going.
Well, you were answering what motivates you to do all this other stuff.
Oh, so yeah. So from a young age, I just wanted to set myself apart from everybody. So like, that's just being me being a competitor. Yeah. So I wanted to win every sprint.
Yeah.
I wanted to score the most points. I wanted to get the most rebounds. Right. Like, You know, you kids are like that with Fortnite. Like, you go crazy when you do this. That, I was just like that with everything that I did. I wanted to be the fastest reader. So that's still in me to this day, where I want to do something so different, and I want to excel at it so much. So I try to find the hardest thing, and I'm like, okay, whatever's the hardest thing, I'm going to tackle that. So writing a book is something that isn't done too often, especially I think the way I did it. You know, it wasn't a tell-all.
Yeah.
You know, it was basically me. I took all the blame for everything.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone expressed themselves. So, what's the hard way? And let's do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think you benefit more from the hard way, too. Yeah, there's more benefit.
Do you fear failure at all? And what is your relationship to failure? Do you ever feel like when things don't go the way? I always tell my kid, there's no good and bad. There's just what you would prefer and what you wouldn't prefer.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But I think sometimes we still believe that if things don't go the way we want, that's a failure. Mm-hmm. And then failure hurts, it's uncomfortable, and so consequently we avoid it. What is your relationship to things not going the way you want?
I wouldn't call it failure. Mm-hmm. I know I used to be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Like when I made a mistake and I had to address it, I had to fix it, I was a little uncomfortable. Like you kind of fight it or push it off. Like I'll do it later, I'll do it. You're procrastinating with it, I'll get it later. Now when I make mistakes, I'm like, cool, this is a new area for me. Like, let me just tackle it. Let me see what this feels like.
Oh.
My only thing, failure, is when you just don't try. So I don't even associate myself with that word. Like, failure is like, oh, what is failure? Like, anything I see, I'm going to go get it. Like, I'll even eat any food now. Like, I'll just try. Like, I just had some, in New York, I just had some snails. And then before, I'd be like, I'm not eating that. But now it's just like, just go get it. Just explore. And as long as you're exploring, as long as you're trying something, there's no such thing as failure.
Yeah. I don't think it's... But I don't think it's, you know, out of pocket to suggest that you're coming to the end of your basketball career. And I wonder, when you look back on it, what is the feeling that you have when you look back at what your experience in the league?
That's a good question. Like, I think Steph spoke on it. Like, last year was just a rough year, so it was just so heavy that at times I would ask myself, like, how much time I got left? Like, oh, I have so many things that I want to get to that I'm anxious to get to that I'm like, I'll just, you know, I'll hang them up in a year or so, or maybe next year I'm done. But I had a really good year, and I had a very healthy year, and it's like, man, you got a lot of time. And like, as of right now and the way the season ended, and I was like, everyone was at peace with the way the season ended up with our team. Like, we've been able to relax. I think we're going to be really excited about next year, like more so excited than any other time because of just the way things occurred, you know, with our guys. And like, right now I'm feeling like I can't wait to get back in the gym. So I'm really excited for it, but, I'm going to just take that, like, day by day, year by year, in terms of how long do I want to play. I got, like, 4 or 5 left. I don't know how I've been able to hold up the way I have. We got some really good trainers. They've done an amazing job. I've always had a close relationship with our trainers, so I'm always in the gym. But I got a lot of time left.
My last question for you before is... what do you want to leave behind as, I want to say legacy, because that's kind of a bankrupt word. Mm-hmm. People overuse it and misuse it. But what do you want the impact of your life to be on the world?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, having 3 kids, you want them to, go after their passions, no matter what it may be. So, like, my son doesn't have to play basketball. I prefer him to play golf. But watching him, and then watching my 2 girls, is like, just go after your passions. And he likes basketball. If he maximizes his talents, he'll play in the NBA. Like, it's easy. So I shouldn't say easy. But he's been put in an environment where he's access to it. He's a really cerebral player. He's very smart, and he can shoot. So, I mean, a lot of guys don't have both those things. So if he maximizes himself, and it sounds easy, but, young fella, you got to work hard. Like, you know what I'm saying, but you got all the tools. You just put the work in. Like I say, hard work is easy. I like hard work, so that just became easy to me. So once you learn how to work hard, you got it. But with my kids, I want them to chase their passions. and just experience life. I went through all the little hard things just to kind of clear all that out for them so they can just go do what they do. But I think in terms of being a professional athlete who has a sense of self and who isn't afraid to go against the big machine that can alter the way we go about life. Yeah. And sometimes the machine keeps us from being at peace because we just chase and chase and chase and chase and chase and chase, yeah, instead of taking time to reflect sometimes, or just accepting, like, if you don't win a championship, that doesn't mean you were a failure. You know, that's a big thing in sports. It's like we define people by our emotions that are attached to the game. So if, you know, if I'm a fan in Denver and this is a great athlete and it's like, well, if you're that good, you should be winning three championships. I need to feel that because I'm a big fan. So if you don't get me three championships, then you're a failure because you didn't live up to what I needed you to be. Mm-hmm. There's a big part of that in the game as well. So I just want athletes to get a better sense of that and that mental space. Like we talked about, it's getting harder and harder for athletes to be at peace because of all the things that are surrounded by the game. It's not the game. We're at peace when we're on the court. Mm-hmm. It's just when we step away, you get an interview. Why did you do this? Why did you do that? Why did you lose? Or is he better than you? Or are you better than this person? So you're really just, you're battling with yourself when you're doing all these things, and then you're on social media trying to build a brand, or you're trying to get an endorsement deal. Like, you know, sometimes it's like, just take a step away. Mm. You know, it's, people call Kyrie Irving crazy, but he's a genius to me. Mm. You know, just the way he perceives things. You know, I don't agree with everything he says, but you can tell there's a soul there, and he's trying to be better and better every day. So I just want all athletes to be at peace with, because sometimes we don't realize is understand where these guys come from. And it's like, it was a miracle just to get out of where they came from. Like, they're supposed to be dead like 20 years ago. Mm. Like, I grew up kind of like that. Like, you know, my brother's best friend got shot in the head. My brother was this close to him. Like, imagine that trauma. Like, you know, like, sometimes there's a disconnect between the fans because the fans that we see around us on the court aren't from where we come from. Mm-hmm. So I want to put that human element back into sports, because when you put the big business and you look at the business side, it kind of separates the two.
Well, I want to thank the JCC, and I want to thank you, Andre, for coming out tonight.
Thank you all.
Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Very happy.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Golden State Warriors basketball player, tech investor, and philanthropist Andre Iguodala, whose new memoir is The Sixth Man. He was joined in conversation by writer and podcaster Carvell Wallace. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalay, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.